Hey, y'all, it's the takeaway for May 21st. Today, getting insurance to pay for mental health treatment can be really difficult.
I have three sessions with a therapist, and then after that, I have to pay the rest out of pocket.
The provider network is very limited.
I think the financial stress is a bona fide contraindication for the therapy.
What Congress tried to do to address the problem and why it's not working. Also on the show, a look inside the busiest immigration court in the nation, New York City.
These judges have the fate of all of these immigrants in their hands right now.
And we continue the juggle, our series of Life in Your 40s. Today, we're talking about work.
I started to notice less energy, stamina.
I'm just about to turn 44. I work in a creative field, and I'm starting to feel like I'm aging out of my industry.
We've got a lot to get to, so let's hit it. In the United States, getting an insurer to pay for your annual checkup is a lot easier than finding coverage for mental health or substance abuse. You told us about it.
When I was relying on private health insurance, I did not have sufficient coverage for mental health care.
The provider network is very limited.
I have three sessions with a therapist, and then after that, I have to pay the rest out of pocket.
Medicare will reimburse me for my psychiatrist.
I was getting charged well over $500 per session. This was unsustainable, and I had to stop.
I had to ration my treatment because I paid out of pocket.
The problem I have is saving enough money for my visit.
And they give me a problem about getting reimbursement.
I'm a mental health counselor, so the work I want to do with my clients is monitored, regulated, and even prevented by a lack of coverage from the insurance companies.
But what am I to do? It's a lifeline.
Now that I'm on medical assistance, I do have sufficient coverage.
I get what I need, but sometimes I have to wait to save up, even though they have a sliding scale.
I think the financial stress is a bona fide contraindication for the therapy. Oh well.
This problem of haphazard insurance coverage is rampant. Mental illness impacts nearly 50 million Americans a year, and substance addiction impacts at least 20 million. Congress tried to address the disparity between medical coverage back in 2008 when it passed the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. That legislation was supposed to guarantee comparable insurance coverage of mental health and substance abuse disorders. But a new report out this week from Bloomberg says some insurers have worked to evade the law, and that patients often find their mental health coverage inadequate. Meanwhile, more Americans are dying from mental health illnesses and addiction. From 2008, when the parity law was passed, to 2016, the suicide rate increased by 16%, and fatal overdoses climbed by 66%. Today, we're going to talk about it. Here to discuss that report is Cynthia Kunz, a healthcare reporter for Bloomberg. Cynthia, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Dr. Patrice Harris, the president-elect of the American Medical Association. Dr. Harris, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me as well.
So, Cynthia, let's start with you. Why did Congress feel they needed to pass a law to improve mental health and addiction coverage to begin with?
This was a mission driven by Patrick Kennedy, and you may recall he crashed his car on Capitol Hill and came public with the addiction and mental health conditions that he had been suffering in his life. And so he drove an effort to create a law that would make mental health equivalent to medical health in terms of what insurers are required to cover. The problem was it wasn't a case of there being a ton of political momentum for this. They actually tacked this on to the TARP bill, which you may recall bailed out America's banks. And sometimes that happens with laws. They get tacked into other things. So this wasn't necessarily the response of this huge outcry, this march on the mall, this idea that millions of Americans were crying out, we need this. Unfortunately, a lot of mental health and substance abuse conditions go people don't talk about them. There's a stigma around this type of medical care that has pervaded and prevented people from seeking care or speaking out.
Dr. Harris, do insurance companies and lawmakers view mental health concerns as serious physical ailments, as serious ailments to begin with?
Well, I have to say the stigma that has long been associated with those who have mental illnesses or substance use disorders still remains. The good news is more people are talking about their mental illnesses, more people are talking about their substance use disorder diagnoses. So we're getting better, but we still have a long way to go to eliminate that stigma and make sure that these mental illnesses and substance use disorders, and those who have them, get access to the treatment they need. You mentioned the numbers. They are staggering. I am a psychiatrist, so I have been intimately involved with filling out paperwork and defending that my patients need more visits, because at times there were visits or limits on the number of visits. So we're getting there, but we still have a long way to go. And I think the key issue is there needs to be much stronger enforcement and oversight of that parity law and other laws that are meant to protect patients with a mental health or substance use disorder.
Cynthia, I want to ask you, since this Parity Act has passed, has access to care increased, or is it that more people are seeking care?
So there are some promising numbers. There was a federal study that came out in February that showed that those who are seeking treatment are getting more frequent visits than they might have been previously. More people are accessing substance abuse treatment in an outpatient setting. But there were other things that showed up in the substance abuse arena. People were spending more out of pocket for care. So there are things that are going on that are they're promising signs. But one of the problems is, in particularly in the enforcement arena, there are any number of entities that could be regulating a given plan. There isn't just one centralized regulator when it comes to enforcing the Parity Act. So the Department of Labor enforces violations in plans that are employee-sponsored, and that's a large bucket. But then there are also state regulators. There are many different types of plans. There are plans that are through the marketplace. There are small group plans. So there are a lot of different potential enforcement mechanisms, because it's a bit of a patchwork enforcement sort of arena, it's made it hard for any one entity to come down and say, okay, I'm going to take on the violations at X, Y, and Z insurer.
Dr. Harris, I want to talk a little bit about what happens if a family or an individual has needs mental health treatment, needs addiction treatment, and that treatment is not covered by their insurance. Can you tell us about maybe an experience that you've seen? What happens then?
Well, the first step is typically, as a physician, I will call or email. Oftentimes it's unclear, someone at the company to advocate for my patient, to see what criteria are needed in order for them to get that treatment. Actually, and that, of course, is actually a barrier, because often I don't know what the specific criteria are for a particular medication or a particular treatment intervention. But that is the first step. But unfortunately, that first step may take days. It may take weeks. And at the end of the day, patients continue to have the symptoms. They continue to have the disease. And it results in a delay in care. And so one of the things that we recommend at the AMA is that any of my patients who are denied this care, a first starting point, although I agree with the patchwork, is the State Department of Insurance. I know over the last year or so, the AMA has been working with state medical societies and state departments of insurance and insurance commissioners to address this issue. I know that the New York Department of Insurance is very well aware of these issues. So is the AG's office, the Attorney General's office. And so what we need to do is make sure these issues are raised to these departments at the state level. That's a start.
Cynthia, you wanted to weigh in.
A lot of the feedback I actually got was from the provider community about how the crux of the problem for the providers is that the insurers are reimbursing at such a low rate that it's uneconomical to take patients through insured plans. And that seems as though it's a pretty clear-cut issue that regulators or lawmakers could be looking at. And in some cases, providers were telling me they were getting denied. They tried to get into a network and they were told by the insurer that the network was full. And it doesn't seem as though that would make a ton of sense considering the data that we've seen and the access problems that people are reporting all around the country.
And it's sort of, as you're talking, Cynthia, I'm thinking about one of the other things that emerged in your reporting were these ghost networks. So I know a lot of people probably experience this. I know I've experienced it when seeking help of an insurer will say, well, go online, look through the thousands of people that we have there, you know, supposedly for you, and pick somebody. And quite frankly, what you found is that there are lots of folks in those databases who are what?
So I've talked to these people who've gone through 20, 30, sometimes 50 calls trying to find an in-network therapist who takes insurance still, who may not be full. A lot of times they're full. They can't take new patients. There are waiting lists. And so that is what forces a lot of people out of network. And then their copays are very high, and that becomes a barrier to care that a lot of people can't afford. And that the law itself doesn't specifically define network adequacy. So that's an issue that lawmakers could potentially look at, is how do we define network adequacy in a way that people aren't in a position where they're calling 20 providers before they find someone who takes their insurance.
Dr. Harris, how do you respond to that? Because are you, I'm sure you're familiar with the fact that these networks exist, that people are sort of shooting in the dark when they're looking for a provider to begin with. And you mentioned delaying care as one of the obstacles that could make someone's symptoms even worse. So how do you see these sort of ghost networks?
Well, I've lived those ghost networks, both as a patient, as a provider. I've seen my name on a network, and I have not contracted with that particular company. And I've also tried to search and help my patients find therapists. And these networks are totally inadequate, or they're very narrow. So I absolutely agree that that is another area that has to have attention.
And one of the things that prompted us to look into this, and it was your reporting, Cynthia, but also the fact that what's interesting to me is that there aren't a lot of legal actions being taken against these companies. We know that in California, the largest fine against an insurance company was $4 million to Kaiser Permanente in 2013. Why isn't there more of that?
So one of the challenges is the way the law is structured under another law that's basically an employment law, essentially doesn't really allow for fines directly from the Department of Labor to the insurer, the end insurer. They might be able to deal with a plan, but the Department of Labor also doesn't disclose the names of the plans that they're necessarily dealing with when they do have enforcement violations. So this is now being taken to plaintiff's attorneys who are finding people who are, from one attorney I spoke to, he was inundated with people coming to him with denials, and he's building class action cases. And there was a very large class action case that went against United Behavioral Health Group earlier this year, specifically dealing with what the judge had said United was prioritizing its bottom line over the needs of its patients. So class action cases like that are probably the way this is going to work through the courts while regulators start to piece together the mechanisms and the actions they want to take.
Doctor, are you encouraged by that path? We have about a minute left in the segment.
I am very encouraged. That ruling really highlighted the pervasive violation to delay in care. And I think one of the things that I've heard from some insurance commissioners is that they don't hear from patients about these violations. So that's why it's very important to notify your state insurance commissioner. But also, the AMA is continuing to work at the state level. Again, these two can be on parallel paths at the state level to work with the regulators to pass state laws to make sure that the insurers are adherent to the parity law. Because I will tell you, we're finding no one has looked at that in 10 years.
Well, now's the time. Dr. Patrice Harris is the president-elect of the American Medical Association, and Cynthia Coons is a healthcare reporter for Bloomberg. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thousands of miles from the U.S. southern border, 18 new immigration judges are working their way through the massive backlog of cases in New York City. The number of pending immigration cases has ballooned in recent years after the Trump administration implemented stricter asylum demands. These additions to the bench in New York City, the nation's busiest immigration court, are part of a larger hiring wave across the country.
We hear so much about the border and these tent cities and these migrants coming and all the lawsuits that are taking place right now. But the places where those cases are going to get decided ultimately will be in immigration court, which is this world that a lot of people don't get to see. And these judges have the fate of all of these immigrants in their hands right now.
That's Beth Fertig, senior reporter covering immigration courts and legal affairs for WNYC. And for months, Beth has been sitting in on immigration courts here in New York City to see how proceedings are changing under the Trump administration with the backlog.
The judges now have quotas. They have to complete 700 cases a year in order to get a good rating. When they're first hired, they're on probation for their first 2 years. So I wanted to look at the new judges in particular to see how they're managing the pressure. They don't talk. They're not allowed to talk to the press. And so I observed them in open cases and a few asylum trials when I was allowed by the immigrants and their attorneys to watch to see how they're managing it. And also, New York City is the busiest single immigration court in the country. The one at Federal Plaza has a backlog of over 100,000 cases. And it's just amazing to see the number of people being processed in that building every day and what they're going through.
Now, part of this is because there were about 200 nationally, right? 200 new judges appointed nationally. How many in New York?
So there's been a move to hire more judges since President Trump took office because of the backlog that you're seeing, which has intensified partly because of some policies of his administration, partly because of the shutdown, partly because more immigrants continue to come, and there's never been enough judges to handle it. So he has added more judges, about 200 more, as you said, but there's still just 435 nationally. There were a bunch of retirements along with new positions, so it's not been a net gain of 200 exactly. The judges' union says they would need hundreds more to manage the backlog. It's a really demanding job. If you're doing asylum trials, some of these judges do 3 or 4 asylum trials a day, which take hours. And if you're just seeing the type of procedural cases where people come and they plea, mostly it's the judges seeing them for 5 minutes and scheduling their trials, that can be 50 to 100 in a single morning that a judge will see. And then they're planning their trials years in advance because of this backlog. And in some cases in New York, people are getting their trials scheduled in 2023. But yet there's this priority from the administration to see the families who came recently first. So they get trials within a year of crossing the border. And I was seeing people who came last summer getting trials in March, April, May, and people who have been waiting years get bumped to make room for them.
You've spent months in immigration court, specifically here in New York City. What were some of the things that you noticed, particularly among some of the newer judges on the bench?
Well, what I found most moved me was seeing that these are very new judges in some cases who just started last fall, and they have to see, you know, 50 to 100 people in a given morning. And you'll see women with children, babies on their laps, kids crying in the hallway because these courtrooms are so crowded, the immigrants wait in the hallways. Some of them have lawyers, some are coming by themselves, and the judges just go through them 5 minutes at a time to see if they have their paperwork, to set the trial date. And you see that some of these new judges have been given the family cases because they have more room on their dockets. They're new and they're less busy. And so a lot of the family cases from Central America that came last fall are being assigned to the new judges. A judge one morning who got a family case that was scheduled to have a trial in May. This family came last summer. They're from Honduras. And the judge said, I've got to get this done fast. I want this done in March now instead of May. And the attorney said, I'm sorry, judge. It would be a violation of due process if I have to do this any faster. And the judge said, okay, I'll keep your old date. But you see that the judges are under tremendous pressure to schedule these cases faster than others while also dealing with all the other cases. It's a lot of pressure for them to handle.
The Justice Department established these new goals for immigration judges, but what does that do to the judge's authority?
Technically speaking, the judges are independent. They work for the Justice Department, but their boss is the Attorney General, and you can't get away from that. So when the Attorney General and the Justice Department said last fall, hey, we want you to complete 700 cases a year or you're not going to get a good rating, that puts a lot of pressure on them. And the judges union has been very vocal about this, saying that they feel like this is sacrificing due process for expediency. the Justice Department has said, no, you can walk and chew gum at the same time. You know, you should be able to do both. But they say in their experience, it's just really hard when you know the government is watching your numbers. And they even have these little dashboard screens on their computers that show in red, yellow, and green if they're meeting their target, meaning green, or near it in yellow, or not meeting their target in red. And you see that if you're a judge on your computer every morning, these little round dashboards. And that's a daunting thing for a judge.
Beth Vertig is a senior reporter covering immigration, courts, and legal affairs for WNYC. Beth, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
This week on The Takeaway, it's all about life in your 40s. Whether you're a Gen Xer or your 40s were many years ago, there are similar themes that emerge in this critical and overlooked decade. And we're going to go deep in a series we're calling The Juggle. Yesterday, we looked at money in your 40s, and today, we're going to talk about work in your 40s. And many of you have shared your stories of being a 40-something worker, from fear of ageism to time management.
Hi, this is Jessica from Los Angeles. I'm just about to turn 44. I work in a creative field and I'm starting to feel like I'm aging out of my industry. I'm worried about whether I can remain relevant enough to continue to earn what I need.
This is Rahajan Sastuwardoyo from Centenary Sloan Island. One of the things I dislike about being an older single person is the assumption in a workplace that your time is less valuable than that of someone who is married and has children.
I started to notice less energy, stamina, and started to develop physical and medical problems that I'd never had before. I found long hours were more challenging. I also felt little tiny stabs of fear occasionally about job security.
Hi, I'm Tennille Allen from Oak Park, Illinois, and my takeaway on a recent Twitter conversation on coping with life in your 40s is that when I'm doing it well, it's exercise, yoga, and acupuncture. When I'm not coping well, it's bourbon and chocolate.
So see you when you're 40, lost and all alone, being comforted by strangers. You'll never need to know.
Bourbon and chocolate, eh? We appreciate you for telling us all your stories here. We're going to talk to someone now, Bridget Schulte, who's going to help us break all this down. Bridget is the director of the Better Life Lab at New America, and she's also the author of Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. And aside from her own research on work, she is in her 50s and has some real life experience to look back on and share. And Bridget, we hope you can, because there's a lot of 40-somethings here going through it. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well. The 50s are good.
Good. This is good to hear. So let's talk about the 40s here. What defines this decade when it comes to work? How is this decade different than others?
Yeah, no, this is a really good question. You know, we've often heard about the midlife crisis, and this is really the age that it hits. And, you know, it hits in a lot of different ways. And they're actually finding through research that apparently there might be some kind of biological foundation to it. So what happens at work is that you're no longer the up-and-coming ingenue. You're no longer the kiddo who's, you know, got these bright horizons and you could go in all sorts of different directions. You've sort of, you know, charted out a path. You've had some successes. You've certainly had some failures that you've learned from. And then you kind of get into this period in your 40s where you're worried, like, am I stuck? Is this all I am? Is this all people see me for? Is this all I can do? You feel like I've got so much more left to learn, so much more left to do. You know, you don't necessarily feel 40. You still feel like you're that 23-year-old, and yet the world doesn't look at you that way. And you don't have that kind of time, and you've got far more responsibilities at home, whether you've got kids or not, that leads to an awful lot of time pressure and juggle.
What are some of the biggest and most damaging misconceptions, about work and workers in their 40s?
Well, you know, there is this certainly now with all this kind of like technology and kind of tech bros, this notion that you have, you're most innovative and you get your best ideas when you're young. You know, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook even used to say, you know, young people are smarter. And I think that that's really dangerous, that that's actually not true. And that what you're missing out on with that kind of youth worshiping culture, which we've kind of always had, but at work, what then you miss out on is all of the experiences experiences that people bring in their 40s and the wisdom that comes from having had sort of a zigzagging path or, you know, having, coming straight up against your limitations and figuring out how to overcome them or navigate them, learn from failure, to pick yourself up and to go on. Those are enormous skills, life skills, wisdom skills that are really crucial in the workplace. And I do think that they tend to be overlooked when we keep thinking for what's the next best, bright, shiny young thing.
Well, and also I want to bring up the idea here that there's another side, I think, to this, is that workers in their 40s who have been in the workplace, let's say, for a minimum of 20 years, if not more, some of whom, like myself, started working in their teen years. So we're talking about 30 plus years experience. That makes you more aware. It makes you more assertive, and you're probably getting paid more. Do any of those things factor into this sort of young, shiny object dichotomy that we're talking about?
Well, it certainly comes to play, you know, say in a financial crisis, and then people are looking at their org charts and figuring out who needs to go. And sometimes if you have that experience and you have that higher pay, people in power might say, oh, I can have 5 20-somethings do the same thing that you do. So there is that kind of precarity or danger, if you will, that comes up that can lead to more sense of uncertainty in your 40s, particularly in some kind of a financial downturn or in some kind of reorganization. But I do think that just the very point that you made, what you bring, the experience, the knowledge, the institutional memory, all of that cannot be discounted.
You know, we often talk about struggles in the workplace and this idea of ageism. We've covered this on The Takeaway before. A lot of people don't know that ageism, technically, the protections begin at age 40. But Bridget, I'm wondering if you can tell us why these protections are so hard to enforce.
Well, it's sort of like anything when you've got a culture, that it really, the workplace culture can be so very powerful, regardless of what the policies are or even what the laws are. Why you've had sexual harassment for so long and so much silence, even though there are laws and protections against that. It's like anything. If you live in a culture, it's defined by its leadership. There's all sorts of buzz right now about millennial workers, and they're now the largest segment of the work population. And so in many ways, people in their 40s feel sort of invisible or overlooked. And this is where it's really important that you make sure that you make your case, you make clear to people your value and what you bring and what you do.
And I want to round out the segment here because your 40s are not all terrible. Like you said, the 50s are actually something to look forward to. Professionally speaking, Bridget, what opportunities are there? How can people who are working and in their 40s make this a more successful and happy experience?
Well, I think a couple things is to recognize that in your 40s, you're often juggling an awful lot at work and at home. You're pulled in a lot of different directions with childcare or elder care. I think the first thing that people can do is give themselves credit for what they do, for all of the things that's on their plate, and have some self-compassion. We tend to be so hard on ourselves. And this is an era of transition where we move from being focused on our individual ambition, our individual sense of achievement and success, and moving into a phase where we're thinking about what can I give back to the future, to the community. So it's a real era of transition. Take the time to recognize that that is what it is. Be patient with yourself and give yourself credit for as much as you do.
Wonderful advice. Bridget Schulte is founding director of the Good Life Initiative at the nonpartisan think tank New America and director of the Better Life Lab. Bridget, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find all our conversations about life in your 40s this week at thetakeaway.org/thejuggle. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about health in your 40s. Share your thoughts and stories with us on social media with the hashtag #TheJuggleIsReal. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.
Hey, folks, I've got some news to share. We're coming up on 1 year that I've been hosting Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway, and we want to celebrate. That's right. We're going to broadcast Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC's The Green Space in New York City on Friday, May 31st at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. If you're not in New York, that's okay. We'll be live streaming the show, so don't worry. Join us for a spirited debate for and against the institution with great guests, and you can get a peek into what it takes to make the show. The event is free, but you need to reserve your tickets in advance, so visit thegreenspace.org/events to secure your seat. That's green, spelled G-R-E-E-N-E. We'll see you there.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.